Welcome. I'm Eric Fleming, host of A Moment with Eric Fleming, the podcast of our time. I want to personally thank you for listening to the podcast. If you like what you're hearing, then I need you to do a few things. First, I need subscribers. I'm on Patreon at patreon.com/A Moment with Eric Fleming. Your subscription allows an independent podcaster like me the freedom to speak truth to power and to expand and improve the show. Second, leave a 5-star review for the podcast on the streaming service you listen to it. That will help the podcast tremendously. Third, go to the website, momenteric.com. There you can subscribe to the podcast, leave reviews and comments, listen to past episodes, and even learn a little bit about your host. Lastly, don't keep this a secret like it's your own personal guilty pleasure. Tell someone else about the podcast. Encourage others to listen to the podcast and share the podcast on your social media platforms, because it is time to make this moment a movement. Thanks in advance for supporting the podcast of our time. I hope you enjoy this episode as well. Hello, and welcome to another moment with Eric Fleming. I am your host, Eric Fleming. Ladies and gentlemen, today is going to be a kickoff for the home stretch toward 2024. I've got a plan for a bunch of great episodes that will lead us into the new year, and this one is going to kick it off. So before we do that, though, it's time for a moment of news with Grace G.
Thanks, Eric. George Santos of New York became the 6th member of the U.S. House of Representatives to be expelled. Jamie Foxx, Sean Diddy Combs, and New York Mayor Eric Adams have been sued for sexual assault under the now-expired Adult Survivors Act in New York, which allowed for such cases to be filed in court even if the statutes of limitations have run out. The G7 foreign ministers called for extending the current pause in fighting in Gaza to facilitate assistance and the release of all hostages. The U.S. dollar sank to a 3-month low as growth in the U.S. economy is predicted to slow down, leading to a potential rate cut. Life expectancy for U.S. babies born in 2022 increased by approximately 1 year compared to those born in 2021, with the largest increase seen among Black non-Hispanic Americans. Derek Chauvin, the former police officer convicted of murdering George Floyd, was stabbed and seriously injured in federal prison. A Vermont man pleaded not guilty to charges of shooting and wounding 3 Palestinian college students in Burlington in a suspected hate crime. Hunter Biden, son of President Joe Biden, has offered to testify publicly in the House Republican impeachment inquiry of his father's administration. A car crash that resulted in the deaths of 2 Americans at the Niagara Falls Bridge caused a brief security scare due to initial concerns of a terrorist attack. Investigations are ongoing. The Biden administration has urged a federal judge to reject a legal challenge to the U.S. Military Academy at West Point's consideration of race in admissions. Oscar Pistorius, the South African Paralympic star convicted of murdering his girlfriend Reva Steenkamp, was granted parole and will be released in January. And former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger died at the age of 100. I am Grace G, and this has been A Moment of News.
All right, thank you, Grace, for that moment of news. And now, my first guest. It is my distinct honor and privilege to have on this program David K. Johnston. David K. Johnston is a best-selling author and Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter who teaches law at Syracuse University College of Law, although he is not a lawyer. Johnston is a past president of the 6,000-member Investigative Reporters and Editors. Johnson's exposés have saved taxpayers more than $250 billion, as officially measured by Congress. He has solved murders and other crimes, exposed spies and foreign agents, and is the only journalist to cause a broadcast chain to shut down after exposing its news manipulations and blackouts. Since becoming a staff writer at the age of 19 at the San Jose Mercury, he has reported for the Detroit Free Press, the Los Angeles Times, the Philadelphia Inquirer, and the New York Times, where his work promoted two presidents to change their tax policies, Congress to pass several laws, and resulted in more than a dozen tax cheats going to prison. His work shut down so many sham tax shelters that he has been called the de facto chief tax enforcement officer of the United States. He lives in Rochester, New York with his wife and is the father of 8 grown children. Ladies and gentlemen, again, it is my distinct honor and privilege to have as a guest on this podcast, David K. Johnston. All right, David K. Johnston, what an honor it is to have you on the program, sir. Thank you for coming on.
Well, thank you for having me on, Eric.
Well, I've seen you a lot on a lot of different television shows, and I've been wanting to get somebody that has studied Trump like you have, but I kind of want to do something a little different with you. So the first thing I'm going to do is something I do with other guests. Excuse me, in that I give them a quote, and it's either something that they said, something they wrote in a book, or something was said about them, or related to the topic we're discussing. And then I want you to respond to that. So your quote is going to be, "The Heart Focus Group reminded us of what every con artist knows. People see what they want to see, hear what they want to hear, believe what they want to believe, and let their hopes and wishes vanquish their skepticism. Unless and until some fact they cannot reconcile slaps them hard in the face, the con's marks will keep seeing the world through the credulous and distorted lens they fashion for themselves." Talk about that quote real quick.
Well, most of my career, which goes back to the 1960s, has been investigative reporting, and in particular exposing con artists, not just ones who steal money from you, but people like Daryl Gates, the police chief of Los Angeles, who I spent 3 years exposing in the LA Times more than 40 years ago. And one of the lessons I've learned from that is that con artists succeed, Donald Trump being the greatest con artist in the history of the world, because he conned his way into the most powerful job in the world, because people see what they want to see. I mean, they just close their eyes. You know, if it's too good to be true, it isn't. And yet, again and again and again, we see people get taken. And once people are marks of a con artist, it's very hard for them to ever acknowledge otherwise. My reporting resulted in a number of people who were tax cheats and promoting tax cheating going to prison. And they were all offered the opportunity to get shorter sentences if they would just acknowledge the fact that what they were saying was not true. And some of them died in prison because they wouldn't acknowledge that, because that would be to acknowledge that they had been foolish.
Right. And I guess that's the, I grew up with the old P.T. Barnum saying, there's a sucker born every minute. I don't know if he actually said that, but they accredit that to him.
Right. Well, when I was a boy growing up in Santa Cruz, California, my father, who had grown up in New Orleans, sent me there in the summer of 63 with instructions that it was okay to be in the faces of my aunts and uncles about racism. And I, being in California, didn't really understand the South until I got there and was shocked. And what I couldn't believe is I would see my relatives engage in discriminatory behavior, and I would point it out, and they would say, "What are you talking about? There's no racism. That's just something you Yankees made up out of whole cloth. It doesn't exist." And that really focused me on the ability to deny what's right in front of you.
Wow. So that kind of leads me to my next question. You covered, and this is quote unquote, student radicals, black politics and development at the San Jose Mercury News from 1968 to 1973. One, what was that like? Two, because you were 19 at the time, from what I understand. Two, how did you get to 1968? Meaning, what was the moment you realized you wanted to be a reporter?
Well, I had become a reporter while I was in high school in 1966, and I was married and expecting the first of what eventually became eight children. And my writing for a little shopper newspaper, a throwaway paper, started getting attention. I mean, they were reading stories of mine on the radio station in San Francisco, 75 miles away. And the San Jose Mercury recruited me. I'm very fortunate that I've never applied for a job in my life. Everybody, including the New York Times, came to me. And I was assigned to cover several communities on the peninsula, Los Altos, a rich suburb, and East Palo Alto. And then I was sent to a lot of demonstrations, anti-war demonstrations and the like, where because of my youth, I could just blend in to the crowd and get a different view to cover this. Sometimes on high school, where there were high school protests. In one case, I got trapped because the cops shut the school down and I took a seat in the classroom where the teacher was very nice to me. And covering East Palo Alto, where a woman by the name of Gertrude Wilkes had for years been trying to organize people and to recognize that they were not powerless, they had power, really made me understand the degree to which it is government policies that create discrimination, that decide how much money you have, that decide the quality of your life. And particularly at the New York Times, I spent years documenting, you know, income inequality, policies that you wouldn't know about that on the surface seem to be absolutely even-handed. But as you begin to dig into them, you discover, no, they're really not. And, you know, one of the best examples of that I can think of in history is one of the best investments taxpayers made was the GI Bill.
Right.
I went to school under it because I'm technically a war orphan. My dad was 100% disabled veteran of the war. So I got benefits to go under the GI Bill to college. Almost no black soldiers or sailors were able to get GI Bill money because the system was set up to undermine the seeming fair, even-handed rules at the top. And I've been writing about this stuff like this my whole career. And I will tell you, even among supposedly liberal journalists, liberal editors, it's sometimes hard for them to see that because they want to say, oh yeah, things are bad over here. But when you tell them, yeah, here's how the system actually works, not the way we've been describing it routinely, not just the place I was working at, but everybody, it's like, well, I never heard that. And I go, yeah, that's what I'm in the business of. It's called news.
Right.
What you didn't know. So it was absolutely fascinating. One day when I was running the Redwood City, the Peninsula Bureau of the San Jose Mercury, the San Mateo County Public Health Director came to me and he said, I want you to look at this new form from the Reagan administration. Ronald Reagan was governor of California to apply for welfare. And it had a box that said, you must list all assets as required on this form. No attachments are allowed. And then it had a 1x1 inch box. And the first thing it said was list all private aircraft, yachts, and something else. The next box, the same size, said list all household appliances, i.e. refrigerators. How are you going to put a date acquired and purchase price? How are you going to put that in a 1-inch box?
Right.
They made it a crime to apply for welfare. And this was so just blatantly obvious once you looked at the form. But understand that almost all journalism, everything but investigative reporting, is an accurate recitation of what sources told the journalist. You know, if the New York Times or the Keokuk, Iowa, whatever it's called, tells you that the mayor or the president said X yesterday, you can go check the record. That's what he'll have said. It'll be absolutely accurate. But That's the official version of events. And the official version of events is never the correct version of events. You have to have the unofficial versions, plural, of events. And secondly, many times I read stories in the Wall Street Journal, a financial newspaper, where it's clear to me, not when I was young, but at this age, and I'm going to be 75 years old in a few days, that the reporter who's written a totally readable piece doesn't really know what they're writing about. They just know what their sources have told them. And this is the great flaw in American journalism, in fact, journalism all over the world. And readers can correct for that. Readers need to understand, okay, I'm getting the straight dope on the official version of events. If it's a quality paper, I'll get some of the unofficial version, critics and other sources who've tied facts now. But this is the way everybody sort of thinks the world operates. And it may not have much to do with the reality of how it operates. And once you put on that lens and you have some skepticism, you're fine. Unfortunately, with the rise of the internet there and crowdsourcing, you have people who will pick out this little detail or that one as if a news story, often written in half an hour or 45 minutes on deadline, is a deeply researched book someone spent 10 years learning about.
So, in other words, you acquired the skill to read between the lines, and congratulations in advance on 75 years. That's an achievement. So how did you evolve from become one of the preeminent journalists dealing with taxes and economics? How did that happen?
Well, I was always, even as a child, interested in power dynamics. Who has power? Who uses it? I write all the time saying, don't be a cynic. Cynicism only helps the people who want to hurt you. But I do have a somewhat cynical phrase I use, which is from observing people with power. And that is, what's the point of acquiring power if you can't abuse it? So, you know, police chiefs in small towns, they'll arrest your kids, but they'll make sure when their kid gets arrested for drunk driving that the officers under them take their kid home. That kind of thing at a very low level. It goes all the way up from there. And very early on, my career took off with writing about taxes. This little shopper newspaper, you know, the kind they used to throw on everybody's doorstep, sent me to cover the school board. And one day they gave out a press release, which the local paper, the Santa Cruz Sentinel, dutifully reported as written. Next year, Santa Cruz Unified School District homeowners will see their property taxes go up. On the average home, we're $34,211, which tells you this is 55 years ago, 56 years ago. The increase will be $43.09. And I just looked at that and went, that's crazy. What if I owned a $25,000 house? I didn't own any house, or a $40,000 house. So I turned the press release over and used long division to calculate how much money it was, and wrote, next year, for every $1,000 the government says your house is worth, you'll pay X dollars more, I think it was $1.40, per $1,000. And of course, if you know what it is per $1,000, anybody can figure out what their cost is. And immediately this got noticed, and other stories got noticed. And I began to realize there was an important story in how we tax people and how we spend people that was being covered only through this lens of the official version of events. And so I would notice, here's a school district like in Los Altos, which I covered, with a school with beautiful lawns and a swimming pool and air conditioning. And then I go to East Palo Alto, just a few miles away, and there's no lawn. The books are very old. The building is falling apart. There's more students per teacher. And the California Supreme Court, 2 years before I went to the San Jose Mercury in 1966, the California Supreme Court held that this policy of more money for wealthy districts and less for the schools in poor districts was unconstitutional and it had to be fixed. Well, guess what? It's 2023 and nothing's changed. It's still the same system because there's no political will to fix it. So anyway, I focused on that. I covered a lot of anti-war demonstrations, many of which were run by people who were zealous, but I don't think particularly well-informed. More and more as I learned, as I studied in school, I worked full-time for the paper and I took full-time college classes. And I began to see more and more how we create systems that perpetuate what is. And the world doesn't want to change. It's very hard to get change. I've written a lot about philanthropy. My wife was the CEO for 30 years of a large public endowment where she focused very heavily on racial inequality here in Rochester, New York, where I live. And one of the things I wrote was I was a columnist on the side for the Chronicle of Philanthropy is it's very easy to give money away. It's very hard to give money away that makes a difference. Mm. And just write a check. But you want to change things. The world doesn't want to change. You got to really work at it.
Yeah. All right. Well, that leads us up to the Trump stuff.
Mm-hmm.
When did you start covering Trump and why? Now, I think you kind of answered that a little bit when you started talking about you were attracted to power dynamics, but right. Kind of go into detail. What fascinated
sure.
you about
this? Well, there's a little bit of a there's a little bit of a backstory to this. I was at the LA Times and I spent 3 years exposing the LAPD. I was the first reporter to seriously examine them. And it ruined my career at the LA Times. I went way beyond where the paper wanted to go. And they eventually pushed me off to what used to be called the women's section. It was called View.
Okay.
They thought I'd write soft features, and I just simply wrote investigative stories in the style of features. But there came a point when there was no point in my trying to stay. It was untenable. So I went to the Philadelphia Inquirer as the bureau chief in Atlantic City to write about gambling. And the reason was the Supreme Court in 1987 made a decision that Indian nations, which are vanquished independent nations under the aegis of the U.S. government, had a right in many cases to have casinos. And I realized immediately they were going to spread all across America. And if there's anything we know about the history of Americans and indigenous peoples, it's that whatever the white man has, he will take it from the red man. Whatever the red man has, the white man will take it away. And I was certain, as I turned out to be exactly correct, that we would see gambling all over the country, including Bible Belt places where, gambling, evil. So when I arrived in Atlantic City in May of 1988 and met Donald Trump right off the bat, I very quickly sized him up as a person like Daryl Gates, the chief of L.A., someone who, if they said something, that made it true. Didn't matter what the objective reality was. If he says it, that makes it a fact. And the first time I interviewed Trump at length, which was a couple of weeks after I got there, with the connivance of his own executives, I came up with a series of questions that showed he didn't know anything about the casino business. They told me he was complete incompetent, and I was skeptical of that. I mean, what do you mean? He owns two casinos. He later owned four. He owns two casinos, and he doesn't know what he's doing. And lo and behold, he didn't know anything. And so from that point forward, well, Trump routinely got coverage of whatever he said as if it was fact, especially in the New York Post. When he dealt with me, he had to know that I was going to push back on facts. And he tried again and again to get me fired. He hired some of the most successful and best paid lawyers in America to go to the Philadelphia Inquirer and then later to the New York Times to demand that I be fired. He never even got a correction because I had all my facts tied down. And I wrote in 1989 about Donald getting to the White House. In 2015, when Donald announced, I was almost alone among journalists in America, certainly nationally known journalists, in saying he can get to the White House because politics reporters said, oh, this is a vanity project. When he ran in 2012, he was really running for a new contract for his TV show. Yeah, Lawrence O'Donnell and I separately were the only two people pointing that out in 2011 and 12, and we were right. And I knew that the politics reporters had egg on their face and they would instead of understanding what was happening and why Trump had a shot, they would dismiss him. And they did. In fact, the New York Times, which wouldn't listen to me about exposing how Donald had 12-year-old and 13-year-old gamblers that he plied with liquor and limos and hotel rooms, and who was in bed up to his eyeballs with one of the biggest cocaine traffickers in America. And there's an extensive public record on all of this. This is everything I write about Donald, as I did with Daryl Gates. It's public record or tape recorded. They wouldn't listen to me, my former editors. And after Donald got to the White House through winning the Electoral College, remember, he lost the election, he won the Electoral College.
Right.
The editor, executive editor of the paper, Dean Baquet, and the publisher, A.J. Sulzberger, ran a boxed front page mea culpa to the voters. Unfortunately, as we're seeing with the 2024 election, they haven't learned a damn thing, and they are making the exact same mistakes they made before. And I'm not the only one saying that now. There are people, other journalists of prominence, who are saying the same thing. It's just astonishing. But you know what? The world doesn't want to change. Convention rules.
So what about him makes him so fascinating that people will follow and support him no matter what?
Well, there are three groups that follow Donald, okay? First and foremost are the economic 90%. They were worse off in 2016 than they were in 1973. Their income was down 4%. That's like they didn't get any pay for the last 2 weeks of the year. Healthcare that used to be on top of their wages came out of their wages. Pensions, if you were a company that had pensions, used to be on top of your wages. Now through a 401k, they come out of your wages. People in the bottom 90% were much worse off, and they didn't know why. I wrote three best-selling books explaining why, but a best-selling nonfiction book sells a couple hundred thousand copies. That's nothing in a country this size. But they didn't understand why was dad and grandpa better off than I am? Secondly, there are all the people who hate the civil rights movement. I mean, we literally have people going around today saying we need to reinstitute slavery.
Right.
It is not hard to find those folks. And Donald Trump gave them permission to spout their racism, their misogyny, their hatred. And so that's the second group. And the third group are these fake Christians, people whose religious beliefs are antithetical to the Bible, but claim to be Christians. And Donald, who calls himself a savior, that's his word, not mine.
Right.
I alone can save you. Donald has, in one of his books, spent six pages calling Christians fools, idiots, and schmucks. And he has said repeatedly, including recently, that his life philosophy is one word, revenge. Revenge is completely rejected in the New Testament. You cannot be a Christian and believe in revenge. So these Christians come to him, and I've asked people who say they support him for that reason, and I get one of two answers. Either, oh, I didn't know that, or I don't believe that. Or, well, you know, God works in mysterious ways. I mean, after all, God gave us Hitler, so we would appreciate what happened to the Jews. I mean, that is such crazy thinking. I don't know what to do about it. Those three groups, the 90%, the people who hate the civil rights movement, and the fake Christians, they overlap very heavily. They are not a majority of Americans. They are maybe a third of Americans, somewhere in that range, a third, maybe 40%. The problem is under the Electoral College, Wyoming with 500,000, 600,000 people gets three votes in the Electoral College.
Right.
California with 40 million people only gets 55 votes, I believe it is.
Right.
And the Midwest states and the Southern states with their smaller populations can decide who's president against the will of the people.
Yeah. And that's a whole other discussion we needed to have about the Electoral College. What should Americans know about Trump that they may not get? I mean, it's been a lot of information. Oh, yeah. He's put himself out there, but what's the one thing that people don't seem to understand about him?
Donald Trump doesn't know anything, doesn't have any moral core of any kind. And as a result, he will do anything that is the spur of the moment of interest to him. We know that he's given away deep national security secrets to an Australian businessman. And if you think that's the only time he did that, you know, you're just being naive. Donald Trump is a threat to our national security. Just a couple of weeks after becoming president, unannounced, he met in the Oval Office with the Russian foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, and their ambassador, Sergei Kislyak, and a TASS, quote unquote, news photographer, whose gadget bag had God only knows what kind of electronic surveillance equipment in it. And we learned right after that meeting, which only became public because of the Russians, that he had given them our most closely guarded secrets called sources and methods. How did we learn that? What, from who did we get it? And almost immediately, articles appeared in a bunch of countries around the world where the national security apparatus there said to journalists, we're not going to share stuff so much with the U.S. anymore. We don't trust them. And we know that there are people who disappeared right after this.
Right.
So I think the most important thing people need to know is that Donald Trump has committed national security crimes for which we'll never prosecute him, because to do so would further endanger our national security.
Hmm. So prosecuting him more would put us more under a threat.
Yeah, because once you prosecute him, he gets the right of discovery, and he gets to say, well, who, what was the source, or what was the method of the by which we discovered this fact? And we're not going to do that. It was not long after that meeting that Russian state television, remember, in Russia, there's no journalism. There's only state television
right. And
state newspapers. There's a meeting going on in a government building, standard meeting, bunch of guys in suits sitting around a conference table. And all of a sudden, the doors burst open. A bunch of big guys in suits come in with a TV camera following. They throw a bag over the head of a guy, and he leaves. It's been widely reported by people who cover national security, which is not my field to cover, that this person who's never been heard from again was believed to have been one of the most valuable sources that we had inside the Kremlin. And the implication of that is that Trump outed this guy, that Trump told this Australian businessman about secrets involving our submarines, which we have, you and I and everybody listening, we have spent enormous sums of money, you know, tens, probably hundreds of billions of dollars during since the Cold War, learning how to make submarines truly silent, especially the way the propellers are milled. And Trump gives away this information to this guy in Australia? There is no muffler on this man. There is no integrity in this man. I mean, contrast his blabbermouth with the night in 2011 of the Gridiron Dinner, where Barack Obama made fun of Donald Trump. I'm glad I don't have the weighty decisions he does, like whether to fire Meatloaf, which infuriated Donald. And right. What was going on right then? That was when Obama was setting in motion the Osama bin Laden capture,
right. Which
ended up in his death, unsurprisingly. But, you know, you wouldn't know that from watching him. He was as calm as could be. Donald is the exact opposite. You know, here we had a president who had an elegant mind, wrote beautifully, is deeply thoughtful, and an actual expert on nuclear weapons. Replaced by a guy who says, I'm the world's greatest expert on 23 subjects. And then his own word show. He didn't know a damn thing about these things, particularly, you know, tax policy, which I'm a recognized worldwide expert on. Donald is not just that he's a fraud and a con artist. It's that he is an active threat to our safety.
So that partially answers my final question, but I want you to kind of tie it up. What is the danger of a second Trump presidency? We've already covered a national security piece.
Donald will do what he tried and failed to do in his first term. I wrote three books about Trump, and the middle one is even worse than you think, was about how they had compromised the government. Steve Bannon said, we're going to destroy the administrative state. What's that mean? That's fancy talk for we're going to destroy our democracy and replace it with a Trump dictatorship. And I have been saying Donald is a wannabe dictator since 2015. He's already announced that he's going to try and prosecute people who are his enemies. I will absolutely be on that list. That he is going to round up huge numbers of people and put them in what can reasonably be called concentration camps. He's going to restore his minister of hate, Stephen Miller. And he will never leave the White House if he gets back in. If Donald Trump gets back in, kiss your freedoms and liberties goodbye. And when I meet people of color, people who are LGBTQ, people who are in minority religions, who tell me they support Donald Trump, I go, you know, do you not realize what's going to happen to you? Because it'll start at one place and it'll just get worse and worse and worse, because that's how dictatorships work. This is about, do you want to be a free people? Do you want to advance the country towards its never yet fulfilled promise of liberty for all? Or you want to have a dictatorship? It's a real simple choice.
Well, David, that's a convincing argument. I don't want to see you go to jail, so I'm going to vote for Biden. But seriously, though, man, I really appreciate you coming on. And hopefully we can get you back, because I know you're a person of demand. And again, I'm honored that you took the time to be on this time. How can people reach out to you? You know, where are you writing? All that kind of stuff.
Well, I'm now writing for just all sorts of different places as I feel like it. On Twitter and on Threads, I'm David C-A-Y-J. David C-A-Y, that's my middle name, J. I have a Facebook page that's open for anybody where I post a lot of stuff. And I write for a variety of people, the New Republic, the New York Daily News, you know, whoever I'm sort of in the mood for. I will have a new book out in, I hope, about a year, which will propose an entirely new federal tax system under which you won't have to file a tax return and wealthy people will no longer be able to escape carrying their full burden.
Well, I
definitely... Much simpler system.
Yeah, I definitely look forward to that.
I'm also trying to write it so that anybody who got through eighth grade will be able to understand it. That's the real trick. So 10th grade, I'm confident I can do. I don't know if I can get it down to eighth, but I'm trying. It's a very simple system that's right there in front of our eyes and nobody saw it. That's part of what, you know, my career has been about, is seeing the what's hiding in plain sight.
Well, that I would greatly appreciate however low, if you get it down to sixth grade, that'd be great for me. David, thank you for coming on. Appreciate you. And we'll catch y'all on the other side. All right. And so we are back. And again, I am honored that David K. Johnston graced us with his presence on this podcast. I've been seeing him on TV for a number of years, and to be able to get him on to talk about his background and about former President Trump really was a treat for me. And I hope it was a treat for you. And I know you could tell that we were really only scratching the surface, even though we talked for a little over half an hour. So as 2024 kicks into gear, the election, I'm pretty sure that we'll try to get him back on. And I'm sure he'll be more than willing to talk about Donald Trump. But now I have another guest. And I am also very, very excited to have this sister on. Her name is Jerry Williams. Jerry Williams is a retired FBI agent, author, and podcaster who served 26 years as a special agent specializing in major economic fraud and corruption investigations. She's now on a mission to show the public who the FBI is and what the FBI does. In 2021, the FBI Agents Association recognized Jerry as their G-Man Honors Distinguished Service honoree for sharing FBI stories through her books, blog, and true crime podcast, FBI Retired Case File Review. Her podcast has over 300 episodes and nearly 10 million downloads. Jerry has also written 4 books. She calls on her professional encounters with scams and schemers to write police procedurals inspired by true crime FBI cases in her Philadelphia FBI Corruption Squad crime fiction series. Her FBI for Armchair Detectives nonfiction series enables readers to discover who the FBI is and what the FBI does by debunking misconceptions about the FBI found in books, TV, and movies. Based on her independent study of how the FBI is portrayed in the entertainment industry, she is under contract with major TV studios as a consultant, helping producers and showrunners get the FBI right. You can learn more about Jerry and her creative work at www.jerrywilliams.com. Ladies and gentlemen, it is my distinct honor and privilege to have as a guest on this podcast, retired Special Agent Jerry Williams. All right. Retired Special Agent Jerry Williams. How you doing, sister? You doing good?
I am doing absolutely fantastic. Thank you for having me on your show.
Well, it is an honor for me to have one of the best podcasters out there on my show. I've listened to your program and it's very, very informative. Hopefully I will get there. But again, I want...
We all start from the same place.
Yes, ma'am. So what I normally do with my guests, if I can, is I try to find a quote that fits them and then let them respond to it. And that's kind of like how I kick off the podcast. So here is your quote. I do solemnly swear that I will support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic, that I will bear true faith and allegiance to the same, that I take this obligation freely without any mental reservation or purpose of evasion, and that I will well and faithfully discharge the duties of the office on which I am about to enter. So help me God. What does that quote mean?
Yeah, I remember that well. Well, of course, that's our oath of allegiance. You know, we swear to that as federal law enforcement officers. I did so at my graduation at the FBI Academy, and I lived by that professionally for 26 years, but I continued to understand the importance of those words even today.
So one thing I learned from your podcast is that at Quantico, all the recruits are asked a particular question. What is your why? So what was your why to join the FBI?
Well, I got to be honest with you, you know, and I always am. When I first learned about the FBI, I was not one of those agents who had been wanting to be an FBI agent all of their lives. I hadn't even thought about it. I was a juvenile probation officer in Newport News, Virginia. I was making $14,000 a year, and I heard that the FBI was hiring people at $28,000 a year. I would double my salary. So my initial interest, being honest, being real, was all about the money. Now, I was in a quasi-law enforcement job. I was a juvenile probation officer. And my roommate in college, I went to Morgan State, you know, hooray for HBCUs.
Amen.
She was a police officer in Baltimore. So I knew about it. It wasn't like I was entering and I wasn't even interested in law enforcement. I was already in the industry and I already had connections. But my main interest, what piqued my curiosity, was the salary. And Then, as I went through the recruitment process, then I learned about what the FBI did and, you know, who the FBI is. And that's when I started to develop my interest in this is serious stuff. And yes, I know I can do it.
Did you ever think your race or gender could be a challenge in achieving your goal of being an FBI agent or being successful once you got in the agency?
I did not think that at all, especially since, I don't know if you can hear that. Yeah. I'm sorry. I got little kids in the background, but especially since I was recruited by the FBI because I was a woman and a minority. They were having a serious effort trying to diversify the FBI. And that's when I, you know, saw the notices and the advertisements for, you know, women and minorities to consider applying. So because they were reaching out and wanting me, you know, I just never even thought about that. That may end up being a challenge, which, again, I'm always open and honest about that. For my first 4 years, it was difficult. And there was a time where I felt that, you know, was almost a breaking point. And I was thinking, you know, this is not for me. I don't seem to fit here. And I'm going to quit. Luckily, I didn't quit. You know, I persevered. And things just got better as I became more confident in myself and the fact that I was chosen, I was hired to be there, and I had a place and a reason to be there. As I became more confident with that and started to take on more responsibilities and work cases and really demonstrate the fact that, yeah, it says special agent in front of my name, just like it does everybody else's, and I can do the job. Things got just so much better. Still some challenges along the way, but definitely none to the level for anyone not to consider this as the best job on earth.
So you experienced what now the young people call microaggressions, but you reassured yourself based on the fact that you were recruited and that kind of kept you going and pursuing and staying in that career for as long as you did.
Yeah. And, you know, and you're hearing some of these things now about affirmative action. And because I was recruited, that also was, you know, some of the motivation for that micro aggression. You know, why is she here? You know, why are they here? Do they deserve this? Do they belong? I truly believe in affirmative action. When you want to diversify, you know, an organization, a group, an industry, but that there is a double-edged sword in that because, you know, there's that unvalidated, unreasonable thought that that person was selected because they were a minority or a woman, which may be true. But the second part is, and they're not qualified. That's the part that is absolutely erroneous and can make me so angry when I hear that, you know?
Yeah, I know. Trust me, I get it. I also get the fact about the money because my dad was a bus driver in Chicago. And he took a job with the Chicago Police Department and, you know, when I was born. So I asked him, why did you pick that time to leave the bus, the CTA, to join the Chicago Police Department? He said, because of the money. You were here. I had to pay for you. So I went for the money. So I definitely understand that.
And again, just because your motivation may not be because I want to serve and protect at the beginning, that doesn't mean that you don't get into that mindset as soon as you step across the, you know, FBI Academy or the police academy. I mean, it's you're indoctrinated. That's the purpose of you being a part of a group. And you soon learn the other reasons for you to be there, because if you don't, you won't be there for long.
That's right. When you learned the history of the FBI as it relates to how the organization investigated Black civil rights leaders and organizations, how did that make you feel as an African American serving in that organization? What kind of went through your mind as knowing how the organization investigates, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I was as angered and frustrated and disappointed as anyone else would be in learning about the history of the FBI and their interactions and treatment of our biggest leaders, you know, Martin Luther King, you know, using illegal and unauthorized electronic surveillance, you know, on him and his groups. But I always like to stress to people, but isn't that a reason for us to become part of this organization? You know, to be able to be there, to see that, to reject it, to raise our hand, to, you know, blow our whistles, you know, when we see something like that. So it's not a reason to reject law enforcement as a whole or the FBI. It's a reason to get in there and to be able to, you know, bring a different mindset and a different thought behind it, because I mean, unfortunately, you know, Congress and the Justice Department and just the anger of, you know, a people got the FBI at that time on the right path, you know, indicating that this is not what we expect from our FBI, and, you know, making that known. But it's so much more than that. I don't want to kind of blow it off and make an excuse. That happened. That's a reality. And it makes me angry. But I know that myself and the minority agents, the Black agents who are in the FBI, who were in the FBI since then and are now, that kind of stuff is not going to happen again.
Right. And, you know, it's always better to fight inside the arena than outside.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
If you can't get in the arena, you can't get into the fight.
Right. And it's like, it's one thing for the outside agitation, but to actually be in there. And I remember being a legislator. I got into a debate with another colleague who was like, we should just leave the building and march and all that stuff. I said, the reason why we are here is because people march to get us in here. Our job is to fight the fight in here, not to walk out with our friends protesting. We're the ones that can make that change. I definitely feel you on that answer. It's always better to fight the battle inside.
Absolutely. And I hope, well, I know while I was there, I did not see any of that, you know, that biased or discriminatory behavior towards the African American community. I mean, I think a lot of times when people think about the FBI and the work that is done, I mean, how many communities have they made safer because they've come in and you know, taken out those people that were harming and bringing violence to our communities. And that's kind of what I like to stress, you know, is all of the good work. Yeah, there was something in the past. And, you know, when you learn about the whole history of African Americans and the FBI, you know, it started with agents that were brought in as undercover against what was called, you know, subversive groups like Marcus Garvey to be undercover. So that started that way. But definitely it has evolved into where some of the FBI's most prominent leaders, you know, the top brass managers are African Americans. So I'm very proud of that history and of the work that we've done in the communities.
Yeah, I had the privilege of, when I was with Fulton County, working under a former special agent in charge, Ted Jackson.
Yes,
and that
Ted.
Yeah, so I definitely can relate to what you're saying there. And in Mississippi, I forget the brother's name when I left, that was the special agent in charge. So you definitely see African-Americans in leadership. And that kind of leads me to my next question. What is the biggest misconception about the FBI? And would you say that misconception is historical or something that has recently come up?
I would say the biggest misconception is that we don't work well with others. We don't play well with others. You see that all the time. It's a cliche on TV shows and movies where, you know, law enforcement's there and the FBI comes in and takes over and takes charge. That is so not the case. I mean, the FBI has developed really unbelievable relationships and partnerships and task force. Every FBI office has several task force where they actually have law enforcement, whether they're state, local, federal, other federal agencies, in their office, sitting there next to agents, partnering up on cases. You know, we even pay for the law enforcement officers overtime, and they provide them with, you know, vehicles to use. They have access to our computer systems and all of our technology, and they have security clearance, high level security clearances, like the FBI agents. And so that whole thing about us coming in, we already know we can't come into a situation and, you know, introduce ourselves and take control. We already know those people. We're already working with them when a crisis, you know, like a mass shooting occurs. We know these people, you know.
Yeah, and that's very serious that you're talking about. But in my mind, the most, and I've seen it a lot on these cop shows and all this stuff, but the one that stands out to me, which was hilarious, was the first Die Hard movie. You remember that? Is like, I'm Special
yeah,
Agent
oh,
Johnson,
absolutely.
And this is Special Agent Johnson, and we're taking over from here, you know? And that is something
that
Hollywood...
The line is, the line is that the detective introduces himself. He says, I'm so-and-so, and I'm in charge. And the FBI agent looks at him and says, not anymore.
That's right. Yeah, so, you know, that's kind of a funny take on it, but that's something that Hollywood has kind of perpetuated. And I know that on your podcast, you highlight either current special agents or retired agents that work with Hollywood now to kind of correct that misconception.
Right. And I'm doing that too. I've got a wonderful side gig as a TV consultant on J.J. Abrams and LaToya Morgan's newest TV show called Duster, which is going to be on Max very soon. So it's a lot of fun helping to correct those myths and misconceptions. And as you know, I have a whole book about that.
That's right. And we're going to give you a chance to brag about all that stuff at the end. But I want to ask you a question based off of an interview that you had with Director Ray. And it was something that I thought was really, really interesting that he pointed out. He said on your podcast that FBI agent recruitment is at an all-time high. Why do you think that is? And do you think your podcast is contributing to that positive view?
Wow. I think when it comes down to it, people realize the important work, the good work of the FBI. Not only do they see it in the news and hear it every day, but again, those TV shows and movies play a very, very vital role. And, you know, on CBS now on Tuesdays, you got a whole FBI evening, you know, of the FBI, FBI Most Wanted and FBI International and FBI True. I mean, so people are hearing, they're seeing it on a fictional, you know, level, an entertainment level, but those stories are coming from, you know, true cases. And so I think that's why, because the mystique is real. You know, what people hear about and see, it's real, that the work that the FBI is doing to keep Americans safe from terror, from international spies, and of course, from violent crime, you know, every single day. So I think that's why. And I would like to think that my podcast, with now, you know, over 300 episodes, is also allowing people to hear those stories and to understand, you know, who the FBI is and what the FBI does.
The reason why that answer that Director Ray gave was, you know, on the news, we see people on both sides of the political spectrum saying defund the police. And now that's becoming more direct by a certain group of folks, defund the FBI. And to hear him say that he's busy flying around, you know, all over the country to graduate, you know, to attending, well, not flying, you know, flying over around to check on offices, but to go to every graduation and just see the number of people graduating and seeing the number of people apply. That's why it kind of struck me, because it seems like there's a political movement to not support the FBI, and people are joining regardless of that.
Absolutely, because they see through the BS, if I may use that term. They see through it because, you know, there's always a alternative motive. You know, there's a motive. There's and it's all self-serving and political to make those statements. But the reality is, if one of those political leaders who are saying defund the FBI, you know, is kidnapped, or somebody breaks into their home and threatens, you know, a terrorist act, or, you know, something happens to a family member, the first thing they're going to do is pick up the phone and call the FBI. So whenever someone talks about defunding anything, and I understand the concept, I'm not an ignorant, you know, to the fact that what defunding means is taking some of those positions and resources that the police are doing that they don't really have the manpower or the expertise to do, and give it to someone else. So I understand that. But sometimes when you hear defund the FBI or defund the police, people are actually talking about dismantling. And for those people, I'm thinking, are you nuts? You know, there is a purpose. You know, even if the FBI or the police come into your community, you know, and they, and, you know, they're hopefully they're there to make you safe. They're there to help you, you know, to live your lives and for you to be able to get to work and take care of your kids and all of that. So I definitely want, you know, to push back, you know, on that concept. You know, we need law enforcement. We just need to be, we just need it to be better. We just need it to be equal. We just need it to be for everyone. We just need it to be respectful of everyone.
Now, you specialized in white collar crime. What fascinated you about that, one? And two, was there a specific pattern you saw in victims of certain financial crimes? I know you can kind of profile the perpetrators. You kind of can see patterns. Were there patterns in the victims that you, as somebody that dealt with that crime, that you saw that hopefully people can learn from, or, you know, to avoid?
Now, first of all, I am fascinated by fraud. It just blows my mind what people can say to themselves that makes it okay for them to take, say, an elderly couple's life savings and just walk away. Or a desperate mother who is trying to get a loan, you know, for a mortgage to house her family, and cheat them out of, you know, their money so that that's no longer possible. Or a desperate business owner who's trying to get, you know, funding for their property, and they end up with a you know, a loan broker who, again, you know, steals their money, a telemarketer who steals their money, you know, all of those frauds that are happening. And I'm fascinated what they say to themselves that lets them do that, because what I know is common for most victims is desperation. Mm. Most people fall for frauds when they are at their most vulnerable state, where they are looking to find ways to make money, to get a job. There's so many frauds that are associated with people trying to find employment, you know, and it is just amazing to me that a fraudster, a con artist can smell that desperation and then use it to their advantage to take money through deception, through lies from people who were trying to get money, you know, and they're losing it at the end. That to me is just even more evil than somebody who, without a thought in their mind, you know, shoots somebody, you know, or you know, holds them up by gunpoint. And I have this saying, I thought this was the quote that you were going to use for me, where I say, with a gun, you can steal hundreds, but with a lie, you can steal millions.
Yeah, I couldn't find that one, but that's a great one.
That's on my website.
Yeah. Okay, I didn't see that one, but yeah, that's a good one, because that's a valid point. It just seems as though that more people are vulnerable to a lie than they are to being physically assaulted or being physically threatened.
Look at your emails every day. Look at your text messages. Are the phone calls. There are more people trying to scam you than you ever, you know, need to worry about as you know, from people that are trying to do you physical harm.
Right. And especially during this joyous holiday season.
Absolutely. This is the time for giving, and this is the time for taking.
Yeah. What should the general public know about the FBI? Because I think, you know, I grew up, you know, Elliot Ness and Ephraim Zimbalist Jr., you know, that show. And again, we've heard the political rhetoric and all this stuff. And now you've got the new shows. What is the thing that the general public should know about the FBI and its duties and its role?
Well, first of all, there's over 300 violations that the FBI is responsible for. So there's no other federal law enforcement agency that has that wide responsibility. I mean, DEA, you associate them with, of course, you know, drug enforcement. IRS, you associate them with taxes, you know, and crimes involving taxes. Secret Service with currency and counterfeiting and things like that. But the FBI has those, the postal inspectors with mail fraud. The FBI has those responsibilities. Homeland Security with terrorism. Again, FBI has all of those responsibilities plus so much more. So the FBI, I'm going to use this as a recruiting opportunity too, right? because we have less than around 5% of FBI agents are African American. It's been that way when I came in, and it's still that. No, when I came in, it was like 2%, you know, or 3%. So it's increased a little bit, but 5%, that's it. 1% are African American females. And so what I like to tell people, if you want a job that has variety and is different every single day, the FBI is something you should seriously consider.
And just to tie in with some of the other stuff real quick, you said that y'all have similar responsibilities to other agencies. Because of what's been going on with ATF, have y'all kind of taken more of a role in dealing with some of those? Well, I say y'all because I know you're retired, but the FBI, have they taken more of a role in dealing with stuff that the ATF would normally handle? or is it still kind of in their purview to deal with firearms and alcohol, tobacco, all that stuff?
Well, again, that is the main focus of ATF, but the FBI and our databases, we are the ones, the FBI are responsible for the actual clearances that allow people to obtain or get a firearms license. So, yeah, we're still involved in those activities, but if there is, say, a mass shooting or, you know, some type of gun violence, you know, we do go to the ATF, you know, to have those traces and to look at, you know, where those guns have come from and you know, the transfers of those weapons. So, yeah, we work very closely with them, but we do have responsibilities in that area also.
All right. So final question. And this is a hypothetical.
Okay.
President Biden, you know, Mr. Ray, after his 10 years, he said, you know what, it's been fun, I'm out. And President Biden calls you and appoints you to be the director of the FBI. And you accept it. All right. What if you...
Oh, this is really hypothetical.
Yeah, I know. Go ahead. I know. That's why I had to classify that. What would be your first priority if you were given that opportunity? What do you think would take the FBI in a different direction? Because you can always improve on what you got. So what would be your first priority? It sounds like you kind of talked about it already with the recruitment pitch, but go ahead.
Right. Well, definitely that would be one. But even at a higher level, it would be perception. Because as a former FBI spokesperson, I did that for 5 years at the very end of my career. I understand how important it is for public perception, public tie-in. Because what most people know about the FBI, they get from books, TV, and movies. They've never met an FBI agent. You know, they know what they hear on the news. And so when somebody is coming to your door or calling you on the phone, your ideas of what your expectations have to do with those interactions. And so I would get out more and speak for the FBI ourselves. So when you hear these innuendos and these ridiculous allegations and, you know, or I would be more forward facing and putting my hand up and saying, wait a minute, that's ridiculous. Let me tell you what's really going on. Now, of course, the other agencies or groups or people or organizations who are spreading this stuff, you know, don't have to listen, but at least the American people have your side of it. I don't know if we push back enough on some of these ridiculous things. And I think it's important to get out in front of it and let people know the truth and prove it, show it.
Well, that sounds pretty good. It sounds like you might be able to handle the job if you get the call. I'm just saying.
Hey, guess what? I don't want it. I'm retired, and it's so nice not having to work anymore, to do what I want to do when I want to do it. So I'm taking my name out of the hat. Okay.
Amen. Okay. All right. So this is the time of the program to promote stuff. So talk about the website, the podcast, all that stuff.
Yeah. So since for the last 8 years, I have been on a mission to show the public who the FBI is and what the FBI does through my books. I have two nonfiction books, FBI Myths and Misconceptions, a manual for armchair detectives, where I go through 20 cliches about the FBI that are in books, TV, and movies. I also have a wonderful, fun little word search puzzle book. And then two crime novels where my main character is an FBI, female FBI agent. Of course, she's black, who is fighting corruption. And one book in the Philadelphia strip club industries. That's a little racy and raw book. And then the other one on a Ponzi scheme that is actually inspired by one of my real cases, the $350 million Ponzi scheme I worked. I also have the podcast. I'm busy. Yeah. I also have the podcast where I have over 300 episodes where I interview exclusively retired FBI agents, and they break down a case from the beginning of the case to the very end when hopefully somebody ends up in prison. So that's the kind of stuff that I'm doing. Again, working with Hollywood, trying to make sure they get it right, you know, when it's possible. Entertaining is their goal, but if we can also educate at the same time. And all of that is packaged on my website at jerriwilliams.com. And that's JERRIWilliams.com.
All right. So tell the folks the actual name of the podcast.
The podcast is called FBI Retired Case File Review. No. And it's available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Yeah, and ladies and gentlemen, it is an awesome, awesome podcast. You will not be bored. Listen to war stories from retired agents. It is fascinating stuff, and it's very revealing. And like I said, I used it listening to it, used it for the research for this interview, and put it on my favorites because you're an incredible interviewer and storyteller. So. It is an honor for me to have you on this podcast. Maybe I can get you back on to tell me the story about the research for that novel about the strip clubs in Philadelphia.
Oh, yeah. That was based on a real case, too. So, yeah, we could definitely talk about that. But yeah. I do want to give your listeners two recommendations. I have two episodes on just the history of African Americans in the FBI, and that is episode 186 with John Glover, who was the second in charge at the FBI for a period of time, and he talks about the FBI's 100th anniversary of African American special agents, and then episode 207, which is with my mentor, Wayne, special agent in charge Wayne Davis, who is in charge of the Philadelphia division, and he talks about Director Hoover, his personal interactions with Director Hoover and FBI diversity. So episode 186 and episode 207. I definitely recommend for anyone interested in learning more about the FBI, African Americans, and diversity.
Well, Jerry Williams, thank you so much again for coming on this podcast. I greatly appreciate it, and I hope people have gotten, well, at least my listeners have a better understanding of FBI because of your appearance. Thank you again.
Thank you.
All right, guys, and we're going to catch y'all on the other side. All right, and we are back. So, Ms. Williams wanted me to convey that she really enjoyed doing her job. And I told her, I think people in the interview can sense that. So, but I told her that I would make sure that I would emphasize that she really, really was happy in her career, and she really enjoys what she's doing now. As a retired special agent promoting the FBI. And I think it's important for us to have people on who have been through the fire and to get really candid responses about their experiences, especially African-American. So I am so glad and so honored that she took the time. All right, ladies and gentlemen, that's it for our program on this episode. And I want y'all to look forward to future episodes as we're going to try to continue to get quality guests on. And I'm still going to do some hot mics. But as stated, as we get more guests on, a lot of my takes to be timely will be on Patreon. Excuse me. So please subscribe on Patreon, patreon.com/A Moment with Eric Fleming. And if you want to hear my hot takes on some contemporary issues that we will not have time to get onto on the regular podcast. All right, guys, until next time.